This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A childhood filled with activism, books, and eccentrics instilled in Katie Munger a need to fill her own life with outsized characters, so she created some. Katie's the author of three mystery series. Each centers on characters who defy expectations. There's Hubbard and Lil. Those books star a cantankerous 84-year-old amateur sleuth and her button-down nephew. Her second series features Casey Jones, a blonde bombshell ex-convict turned private eye. And the hero of her latest books is a police detective stranded in the netherworld between life and death. Katie Munger lives in Durham, and when she's not writing mysteries, she works as communications director for progressive causes in North Carolina and raises her teenage daughter, Zuzu. Crime novelist joins me now today to kick off Law and Order Week, our annual look at the justice system. Katie Munger, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
You have been writing mysteries for about three decades now. Did you know that?
No, that's a shock to me.
Did it come as a shock to you?
When you put it like that.
a long, long time. Well, and how did you get started?
Well, my parents raised me to be a writer, and in the household I grew up in, it was impossible not to become one eventually. But, of course, you never want to be what your parents want you to be. So although I did go to UNC Chapel Hill and was part of the creative writing program, I kind of rebelled right out of college, and I just wasn't ready to face that empty page. So I worked on Wall Street for a number of years, and when I was 30, I decided that I did want to be a writer after all. And I sat down to write a book. And, you know, being from North Carolina, there was this rich literary fiction expectations that came with it. And it was overwhelming and paralyzing in a way. So though I did start a fiction book just to loosen myself up and for fun, I decided to write a mystery book. I turned to the genre I enjoyed reading the most. And lo and behold, probably because I was more relaxed when I wrote it, the characters were richer, they were probably truer to life. It was just more fun. And that was the book that sold first. And that kind of sealed my fate, because after writing that first book, I found that I so loved hinging that plot on this central element of a crime, which brings out the best and the worst of people, that I've kind of never been able to go back to regular fiction.
And tell us about that first book, because it was also centered on Wall Street. Not surprising.
It was. I worked for almost 5 years at America's oldest and largest private bank, very buttoned-down institution. And that was my first exposure to Northerners, for one thing, after being raised in the South.
We're not all like that. I just want you to know.
You don't have a great deal of money?
That's for one, yeah. And this is, by the way, forgive me for interrupting, but this is Wall Street in the 80s.
This is gecko territory. Yeah. This is go-go Wall Street, people starting firms, money flowing in after a recession, by the way, you know, after a very stiff recession at first, and entrepreneurs and just so much money. It was a whole new world to me. And also, for the first time, I was exposed to people that weren't Southerners, people that wore their anger out front that could be brusque and rude. And I found I loved rude people because you knew where they stood. You know, yes, they were rude, but you knew that's how they really felt. And I was fascinated by them. So I kind of poured all of that into my first book, I think. If you read Partners in Crime, and that's under a pen name, Gallagher Gray, you'll be seeing New York through the eyes of kind of a naive girl from the South who saw a whole new world and kind of was very intrigued by it.
And we should go back a little bit. This expectation of your parents that you be a writer, your father was editor of the books page for the News and Observer, right? And your mother was
Well, my mother started out as a reporter for the Greensboro Record, a fashion reporter. And early in her career, they said to her, oh, there's some kind of disturbance down at the lunch counter. You know, go check it out. Everybody else is busy. Well, of course, that was the famous sit-in. And I think that probably shaped her life a great deal. She had brought with her from her childhood sort of a deep love and appreciation for the underdog. Oh, she hated bullies. She loved people who sort of were given the short stick in life, and she was not afraid to stand up for them. And so our whole lives, she was an activist for various causes, whether it was civil rights or consumer protections or saving a 300-year-old live oak in Cameron Park. My mother was out there on the front line.
It sounds like a pretty interesting household. Six kids, a father who's reading books and writing about books, your mother's an activist, people coming in and out all the time, right?
Yeah, I think interesting is probably an understatement. It was a very bohemian existence, but I think probably bohemian by necessity. We also had my grandfather living with us. So you've got a house full of, you know, six children, blended family, three adults, enough basset hounds to form rival packs and roam the house. It was insane. And my father would literally make piles of books that he would get to review. So if we needed something to do or we were bored, you just had to bump into a pile of books and take whatever was on the top or the bottom or whatever. And my mother liked to collect people. So my whole life, people from different countries. I remember when I was very young, a man named Dietmar came from Germany and he was riding a motorcycle and he built an igloo of all things in our backyard when it snowed. And so my eyes were opened up to the world. A frequent guest at our house every year was Sally Rand, the famous fan dancer. And if you've ever seen The Right Stuff, she's the fan dancer in the time of Lyndon B. Johnson mm-hmm. that's on stage with the big fans. She used to come every year to the Raleigh Little Theater, and she loved my mother's pea soup. So, you know, knock on the door once a year, and this woman would come in. This was a 75-year-old woman who still took her clothes off, basically. She was wearing a bodysuit. And it was just amazing. I learned very early that age was not necessarily a boundary,
wow.
that you could be eccentric and true to yourself and still find your place in the world. And I think that really has informed not only my personal development, but certainly the characters in the books.
Mom, there's a fan dancer at the store. The door, she wants some pea soup. Can we let her in? And you did. And so, well, maybe this is then the genesis, any part of her and Aunt Lil, who is one of the characters.
I think so. I mean, I have had a number of very strong older women in my life. You know, I was raised Southern style, so I had very many aunts. They're not related to you, but you call them aunt. My aunt Mary Lyman, my aunt Doug Haas Bennett. You know, they were just wonderful examples of older, strong, capable women. But Annie Lil is actually based on a real person that I met, and she was the elderly aunt of the man that the T.S. Hubbard character is based on. And the thing that struck me about her was when I first met her, and she loved her Bloody Marys, so she'd already slugged back a couple when I first met her. And she had a grip like a steel vise. And here's this, I think she's this sweet little old lady, and she leans over, she just grips my arm and goes, "So, who are you and what are you about?" And I'm like, whoa.
They are direct up here in New
York.
They
are very direct. And she was Auntie Lil in my books.
Well, would you read for us? This is Partners in Crime.
I will. This is from Death of a Dreammaker. It's maybe my favorite book in the Gallagher Grace series. And what's happened at this point is that Auntie Lil and T.S. Hubbard, they're at a funeral of someone that was a lifelong friend of Auntie Lil, and she's supposed to throw dirt on the grave. And like everything else in her life, she makes a way too big a deal about it. And she spots a body in the grave below the coffin. So there's two bodies in the grave. And she has announced that there's a body in the grave. And T.S. Hubbard, who's always embarrassed by everything she does, is like looking for any way to get out of this situation. And I'm going to read a part that starts right after Auntie Lil is announced. It's a body and there's an arm attached to it. The widow scurried forward and clutched at Auntie Lil. The rest of the family began to whisper and appeal to the rabbi with confused expressions. Sensing that his control of the ceremony was in danger, the rabbi took action and darted toward the widow. His legs became tangled in the tent ropes and the canvas began to buckle. A mourner screamed. Alarmed, T.S. whirled around to grab at the metal support pole, sending Auntie Lil's pocketbook swinging in a wide arc. The heavy leather purse smacked the rabbi in the center of his back. He stumbled toward the grave and grabbed at the widow's raincoat, locking onto her arms as he knocked her over the edge of the grave. He fell on his face in the mud halfway over the edge of the opening and somehow managed to hold on to the widow. Her screams ran through the stunned silence of the graveyard as she dangled from the rabbi's grasp. "He's going over too," someone shouted from the crowd. It was true. The rabbi was dragged inches closer to the edge of the grave by the panicked thrashing of the screaming widow. "Hook your heels into the mud," someone called out helpfully. The widow's scream stopped for an instant, then grew even louder. "Do something," T.S. shouted. Auntie Lil darted forward and thrust the ceremonial gold shovel at the rabbi as if he were a truculent beaver refusing to return to his cage at the zoo. The rabbi made a useless grab for it with one arm, releasing one of the widow's arms to do so. She shrieked with fresh alarm and, displaying an astonishing show of strength, thrust her body upward so that her head bobbed up above the grave top. She lost her grip on the rabbi's arm, but grabbed successfully at his legs, clutching his trousers with both hands. "Let go of my pants," the rabbi demanded indignantly. He made another grab for the gold shovel and missed again. "Don't let go of me, you bastard," the widow shrieked as she tightened her grip. They were her final words before, in a flurry of unrabbi-like oaths and a flash of scarlet undershorts, the rabbi's tenuous grasp on the astroturf gave way. With a sucking sound, the pair slid down the steep embankment as swiftly as a pair of otters at play.
Katie Munger, reading from Death of a Dreammaker, part of the Hubbard and Lill series that she writes under the name Gallagher Gray, my guest this hour on The State of Things. Did the characters come first for you? In, they are lively characters. Was that the first thing, or did you? I mean, there's also a plot, and it's an intricate one.
I think it's always the characters that come first with me. I think that when I don't even know it, a little seed takes root in my mind, and you know, like a pearl forming, I'll add layer after layer of their character around them, and then another one will pop up, and eventually my mind will start connecting them and thinking about how they could interact, and then the last thing I'll do is I'll sit down and I'll say, well, what could connect them? What could bring out the best and the worst in them? And I will actually diagram a plot very thoroughly. I think in terms of spatial and schematics, and I'll draw a book and then I'll outline it. And before I even write a word of it, I have a pretty good map to follow.
We'll find out how closely she sticks with that map when our conversation with Katie Munger on The State of Things continues. Next, the indefatigable champion of the underdog will meet Private Eye Casey Jones, star of the popular mystery series by Katie Munger. You'll hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest is Katie Munger. She lives in Durham, where she writes mystery series and works as a communications consultant for nonprofits. She's the author of the Hubbard and Lill stories under the name Gallagher Gray, and her second series features a woman named Casey Jones. So there you are, making a living in New York. You're a communications expert and a novelist now. You've got the Hubbard and Lill series. What made you move on to Casey Jones?
Oh, you know, one of the things was that I was married at the time to a rock musician, and I was feeling like a fish out of water. He was a fabulous person. The world he was in, not so fabulous if you were a woman. I just didn't fit the stereotype of the women that sort of fit into and love that world, and I was it's kind of angry, I think, that he was being taken away from me by these idiots in suits and human refrigerator-sized bouncers that wouldn't let me in the backstage, even though I had an all-access pack and a pass and a wedding ring on my finger.
It was the wedding ring.
That's
what got you ejected.
Yeah, I felt like moving into my middle finger.
And this is a musician who we may know.
Yes, Andy York. He plays guitar now for John Mellencamp, and he was a great guy. The world he was in, not so great. So I think I wanted to move on to a brand of feminism, probably in some ways. And at the time, Sue Grafton was very popular, Sarah Paretsky, but their protagonists, they were very competent PIs, which was wonderful if you were into the women's sleuth. But they seemed to have to pay the price in like bad relationships or not having a boyfriend. Or I'm like, well, now wait a minute. That's not any fun. So I envisioned a woman who was not only a really good PI, but kind of strong and had fun and liked sex and smoked cigarettes and liked a drink or two. And of course, with any good PI, you want them to be on the side of the disenfranchised, those people have been shut out of the justice system. So I wanted to make her an underdog as well. Hmm. And I thought, okay, well, really, the last class of people that it's acceptable to make fun of in America is kind of white trash, right? Still that way. I thought, okay, I'll make her white trash. And originally, I set her in New York City. But when the book sold, they said, well, you know, books set in New York City don't sell very well. Can you move her down somewhere else? And I thought, okay. I had just gone to my high school reunion. I was leaving there, and I got 3 hours up on 85 and 95, and I reached Richmond, and I literally had to keep myself from turning around and heading back down south. That's how much I missed being home in the south. So everything kind of came together, and I thought, you know what? I'm moving back there, and I'm going to move my book back there with me. And so I relocated her, rewrote the book, set her in North Carolina so that I would know what I was writing about. I could be there in the environs. And that's how I ended up with Casey Jones.
Did it prove challenging to you? Because I think you've done it quite successfully with her, but it would scare me to make her successful socially, to not have that particular problem that so many other female sleuths have. It's one of the things that makes them interesting. And now you've set yourself this challenge of saying, well, I'm going to take that prop away. I got to find something else about her that people are going to engage with.
It was difficult in that a lot of readers of these types of books, they love a love interest, you know, they like one. But it's not really very dramatic if you're with the same person for a really long time and everything's going great, you know. So I kind of found myself, you know, rotating love interests for her in and out of the books to keep that kind of interesting. So I still had a lot of challenges and fun in that regard, and I could spring surprises on people with who she got involved with. But I also built a really rich set of secondary characters in her supporting cast of characters. You know, I had my favorites among them, and it was amazing to me how I would begin a book and suddenly a character would just come alive and insist to be a bigger part of that book than I had planned them to be.
She gave her the room to do that.
And she was confident enough to give her sidekicks the room so Bobby D could step forward, or Marcus Hill, her sort of gay sidekick in the Durham Police Department, or inside source. And it was really wonderful. As a writer, I think you're smart when you let the characters lead themselves in those directions.
So who was the model for the gay police officer? Because I know the Durham police are good. Would you, instead of doing that, maybe you could read for us to give us a sense, a real sense of who she is. And I think if you read...
Sure.
You can set this up, but it comes right at the beginning.
It is. I think if I'll just begin at the beginning of Money to Burn, which is the third book in the Casey Jones series, and it's kind of fun. It's set in Durham, and the plot deals with the very wealthy, the haves versus the have-nots, and this is chapter one. I never smoke after sex, though I have been known to purr. I offered this tidbit only because the skinny guy in glasses was asking. I've had clients in all flavors, but Thomas Nash was a new one. At around 6'4", he weighed about as much as my left thigh and had unruly light brown hair that waved at the temples. His face had a perpetual sleepiness to it. Drooping eyelids and wide, narrow lips made him look sexy in an intellectual sort of way. He reminded me a little of Leslie Howard in Intermezzo. I wanted to pull off his glasses and plant a big one on that expressive mouth just to see if smoke would billow out of his ears and steam blow from his nostrils. Unfortunately, I am more early Courtney Love than Ingrid Bergman. I suspect he would have fainted from fear had I attempted the maneuver. "Are you listening to me, Miss Jones?" he asked politely. "Miss Jones, yikes, he must mean me. I'm Casey Jones, private detective sans the official license, though I keep that little fact to myself, tethered by fate and cruel necessity to a 360-pound blimp named Bobby D., who does have a license and who fancies himself my boss, though never my superior." "Could you repeat the question?" I asked, still imagining what he looked like naked and wondering why I cared. The man was wimpy, but he had something. It wasn't athletic grace, however. So far, he had tripped over a leg of Bobby's chair, run into the back of my office door, knocked over his coffee, kicked my trash can, and dropped his pen three times. The guy would be positively lethal on a dance floor. "I asked if you smoked at any time at all," he repeated. "It's very important that I know." "No," I assured him, "I absolutely do not smoke, not even after six gins in a row. In fact, I have been known to swat cigarettes from the mouths of 14-year-old strangers on the street while lecturing them on the evils of tobacco."
Katie Munger reading from Money to Burn, part of a series featuring Casey Jones, who is a woman clearly comfortable in her own skin and has her own sexual fantasies. This is the female detective, the version of the Sam Spade, I guess.
It is. And one of the fun things about writing her is, of course, I get to put in, you know, the type of person I get crushes on. I love clumsy people. So I got to write it into this character. You know, they're so adorable.
I just love the fact that she starts out with what you read is that I never smoke after sex. And the question was, have you ever smoked in your life? So you see how her mind works right off the bat. Did she come out full-blown for you? How long did it take you to develop this character?
Well, interestingly enough, the first book that I read from, Death of a Dreammaker, she's a minor character in that book. She appears as this sort of shadowy figure that eventually helps with the investigation. And I thought to myself, well, TV shows spin off characters. I think I'll spin off a character to its own series. So she sort of was less developed in that series. But when I gave her own books, I kind of fleshed her out and modeled her a little bit on myself, quite a bit on my friend Donna, who now lives in Oregon, who I just have admired the verve with which she greets life each day, and a number of other people.
She has a backstory of her own. You talked about a PI license that she doesn't talk about, probably because she couldn't have one as a former convict. Tell us about her fictional backstory.
Well, I wanted to make her somebody who had been shut out of the justice system as well. So she comes from a dirt poor background in the panhandle of Florida. She does not feel worthy herself. Her parents were murdered. You find that out in the first book. They never found out who did it. And because she was so poor, no one really pursued the case. And then you find out from her backstory, she met a fairly wealthy ne'er-do-well who gets arrested on a drug rap, and she takes the rap for him, thinking that's the right thing to do because she's married to him and she's in love with him. And in the course of spending 15 months in a Florida women's prison, she comes to realize what a sap she was. And when she gets out, she can't get a PI license because of her record, and she moves to North Carolina to start over.
This is an important issue these days. Women's prisons are filling up in part because of federal drug laws that make anybody in the house culpable. That gives prosecutors leverage. So if you don't want to testify, we can send you to jail. That's how they play their game. A lot of women are going to jail because of that. Were things like that? And do these sorts of issues, and again, thinking about your activist background, do they make their way into your books?
Oh, they certainly do. A couple of different things. I think the idea of a dual justice system for the wealthy versus the poor runs through all of my books. The idea of women serving time behind bars. My mother, by the way, was one of the first administrators of the WINGS program at Women's Prison in Raleigh, and I helped her with that. So I knew from the time I was a teenager women that were in jail and why they were in there.
Tell us about the WINGS program.
It was a program that was designed to help women who were incarcerated express their emotions in more productive ways through the arts, through music and dance and writing and painting. And I met a lot of women that way and came to know their character, came to know why they were in there. And it really struck me how so many of them were in there because of a man. Either they had dispatched, shall we say, with a man in their lives, or they had done something because a man in their lives told them to. And I think there's probably an element of that in the Casey Jones, and also in the last book in the Casey Jones series to date, Bad Moon on the Rise. That actually takes place, a great deal of it, within a women's prison up in the mountains, a fictional one. So that runs through it. And the whole idea of starting over, I think, which is, of course, very difficult to do when you get out. I think that's something that I address time and again in my books.
If you think about the days when the sort of hard-boiled detective got started with Chandler and Hammett, that's a period in American history where people were very much aware of class and very mm-hmm. conscious of the struggle. Mm-hmm. What about these days? Are we the same people? Do we have the same kind of consciousness? And do those questions track the same with us as they did?
I think that absolutely the questions are still relevant and obvious to many people. I think it's not as cut and dried as it used to be because there's this strange feeling or perception in America that you are somehow wealthy or one of the haves if you watch them on TV. You know, we watch a reality program with the Kardashians or Paris Hilton, and we think, you know, we are one of them too, just because we're observing them. And there are many people who are middle class or falling down to lower middle class or poor, and they don't know it. They aspire to be wealthy, and they don't have this sense of, wait a minute, is it really fair that so many people, 2% of the people, have 98% of the money in this country? Is it really fair? I'm afraid we get distracted and the issue gets muddied by the way we worship the wealthy and make them into faux royalty and entertainment.
Is that because of some sense beyond our seeing ourselves perhaps reflected, albeit falsely reflected, but also that we have some kind of aspiration that we think is really possible, that, you know, we want to be that guy someday? So don't change the rules. Let him, you know, conflict of interest, fine with me, because someday I'm going to be the CEO of a brokerage firm.
I can think of no other explanation for why people tolerate the current system. They must think that, you know, they'll be there one day. If they vote a certain way, they'll be one of those people one day.
Mm. So you've written these books, you've got these characters, and yet they're straight ahead. They're mysteries. I mean, they're not designed and they're not intentionally political. Although you've had a couple of cases. I guess your first Casey Jones book came out, and you got some feedback from readers who thought you were heading in a political direction.
I did. My books are out in ebook format now, so I've been exposed to sort of a wider array of readers. And every now and then, I'll get an email from someone who was probably, my guess is, conservative politically, and they've read Legwork, the first book in the Casey Jones series, and they'll write me and say, well, why are you preaching politics, you know? And I'll write back, and I'll say very, very nicely in a nice way. I'll say, look, clearly you didn't read the whole book, because the point of that book is it sets political perceptions on ear. It's not any one political viewpoint. And I tried to play with what people thought. And please finish reading the book and then get back to me. I mean, I respect everybody's right to have a political opinion, but I actually do consciously try to keep it out of my books as a plot point because I don't think people really enjoy reading about
it. But what is in the books, and I think in all of them, are characters who one way or another are disappointed by or hurt by a system that we have, and it is the system that we have. It's not a broken system. It's the one we consider our criminal justice system.
I think so, and I think that's probably a fundamental theme of my life is people railing against the system, and it seems like a useless thing to do, but really systems only change when people rail against them. That's the only way to change them.
Well, and impossible. And who would have thought Libya would have fallen? I mean, who would have thought Serbia would have fallen and the Soviet Union? So it's fascinating, too, that these things actually do happen, however impossible it looks, however puny we feel in the face of these systems. They actually change when you work at them.
They do, and it all starts with a person, you know, who took on the impossible, and it turned out to be not so impossible after all.
Is that one of the things we love, and what explains the enduring power of these kinds of characters? The detective, it's one person. It's usually one. Sometimes it's a pair. And they're up against a system that they don't fully understand. And we identify, I guess, with that as Americans, don't we? One
person. I think
so.
I think the lone person railing against injustice, the fact that you can believe, we want to believe that one person might come along and save us or that we could be the hero. People like to be heroes. I think they like to see themselves a lot in those protagonists as well.
The good news in that is that we can use story to sort of power our imagination. I guess the bad thing is waiting for that hero or the savior and expecting that to be somebody else.
Yes, I'm a firm believer in looking within oneself to find the hero that you need.
Will you read? I know you've got another reading prepared from the Casey Jones series. Could you read for us?
Oh, a little bit from Casey Jones? Sure. This one is from the beginning of Bad to the Bone. That was the fourth book in the series, and it got a lot of attention, probably because it was blonde on blonde. Think of, you know, Cell Block B movie, blonde on blonde fighting. And this was from the very beginning of Bad to the Bone. Let's see. It was one of those desolate, bone-ringing winter days that sweep through the South a handful of times in a century, freezing street bums to building grates and sending the downtown whores shivering home to their grandmas. Anyone with a lick of sense in Raleigh, North Carolina, was huddled indoors, contemplating the bourbon bottle and praying for sunshine. My ex-husband never had a lick of sense in his life, except when he married me, of course. Bobby D. was the first to spot him. "Look at that moron," he said. I joined him at the window, and we stared out at a tall figure hunched against the icy winds. The man was wearing a fleece-lined denim jacket and a cowboy hat, clearly no match for the cold. Reality slapped me upside of the head. I knew that hat. I knew that hunch. In fact, I knew that moron. Worse, I had slept with him approximately 2,623 times before I wised up. Not that I was counting or anything. "I can't believe it," I said. "That's my husband." "Your husband?" Bobby's mouth dropped open. A half-gnawed French fry toppled out and landed on the toe of my boot. "My ex-husband. How the hell had I made that mistake after so many years?" "It's okay, Casey," Bobby said with annoying sympathy. "The tongue is always the last to know." He spoke with the authority of a man who has been married so many times he keeps a separate little black book just for ex-wives. We stood shoulder to shoulder, watching the cocky bastard who had once been mine swagger down the deserted sidewalk toward our door. I'd know his walk anywhere. It was the bow-legged cowboy rock of a Florida panhandle hotshot, a strut that could carry him from a hot bean field to a dark beer joint to the deck of a 40-foot cabin cruiser, all on someone else's credit card. Jeffrey Carmichael Jones. There was a time when he had been my life, but that was then and this was now. "What do you want me to do?" Bobby asked nervously. Was my beloved 360-pound boss actually quaking in his faux leather boots? "Shoot him dead," I suggested. "What?" That stopped him, French fry halfway to his mouth. "Just kidding, I'll take care of it. But stay close in case I need help kicking his sorry butt back out the door." "That's what I like about you, Casey," Bobby said. "You're so sentimental."
Katie Munger reading from the Casey Jones series, that one from Bad to the Bone. You talked about the characters that you place around her, the fact that she gives them the space because of her own confidence to navigate the series. You think about a guy like Bobby D, do you have to be conscious about them from book to book, make sure that they sort of retain some of their character, but I guess I'll let them grow a little bit?
Absolutely. And that's kind of a realization I came to recently about myself as a writer. And it's an unfortunate realization because I fear that maybe the series is dying. But I am awful at writing short stories. I'll just admit it right here and now. I'm just not that brief. And I can write a good standalone book. But what I really, really love is writing a character over the arc of a series. I love having this imaginary world that lives in my head from book to book and playing with and finding ways to make each character grow and change in a logical, from the heart way in each book. So I just have to admit it, I'm a series character and I'm not even sure I could do a standalone at this point.
Well, the series are doing quite well, and so I think you can stick with those for a while. Katie Munger is my guest, author of three mystery series and a communications consultant herself when she's not writing. She lives in Durham, and our conversation continues. Next up, a dead detective searches for redemption. Conversation continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. My guest today, Durham-based novelist Katie Munger. She is the mind behind three series of mystery novels, her latest under the nom de plume Chaz McGee. You've got three names now. You are Katie Munger, Chaz McGee, and Gallagher Gray. Where did the names come from, the pen names?
Gallagher Gray I put together from family names of my grandmother's. It was sort of a sabrosa blow for feminism. And the Chaz McGee came from an imaginary friend that my daughter had when she was younger. And I thought, okay, he's a ghost. Why not choose from an imaginary friend to be the pen name for that series? Although I will say that my new book, my third book coming out in that series this December in the UK and April in the US, is going to be brought out under Katie Munger, and hopefully they'll put Chaz McGee as written by Chaz McGee, but the publisher decided to bring it out under Katie Munger.
And why do you do that? Do you have a pen name to
keep? Well, honestly, many people choose pen names just to start over with their marketing numbers because the big chains pull what you sold last time and you're hoping to get lots of first orders. But I actually do it mostly because the tone of the voices, as will become obvious in a moment, are very different. And I would hate for somebody expecting Katie Munger writing Casey Jones to pick up a Chaz McGee and go, this is not funny at all. So I try to just differentiate because of the tone of the series.
Tell us about the Dead Detective series.
Well, the Dead Detective was the only aha moment I've ever had as a writer. I was searching for a way to be reassuring about life and death. I felt a little guilty that I had contributed to the idea of death and murder as entertainment in my Casey Jones series. And with all the news coming at us, I really believe it affects us whether we know it or not. And I think it's a fearful world we live in now. And I really believe that there is some sort of afterlife or place that energy goes, that death is not the end. And I don't know why, but I have really no fear of death in that final step. And I wanted to write a book that allowed me to reassure people more. And I've also always been very, very fascinated by sort of broken, battered people, depressed people who had great potential and couldn't bring themselves to really live it and fulfill it. And I wanted a character like that. And I just was sort of half asleep and half awake one day. And I just thought, oh, a dead detective, a detective who was an alcoholic and messed up his cases and really bungled it while alive. And he cannot move on until he undoes some of the wrongs he did and actually does even more good in this strange afterlife he lives in.
So he makes contact with, or in a sense works with, his replacement on the force.
Yeah, and he sort of, he doesn't fall in love with her, but he admires her vitality, how full of life she is, and he tries to help her, and he finds ingenious ways to kind of guide the investigation or help out. And it's really fun because there's no rules in this. I get to make them up, you know, when he can manifest, when he can't, what can happen. And it's actually turned into a series that I think I have a fair number of religious readers, much to my surprise, because it does get into the issue of, does evil exist in some sort of concentrated form? And if so, what is it? And what do you do about it? And if evil exists, then good probably exists too. So it gets into some pretty sweeping themes there when you get into it.
It does. And Kevin Fahey also has the opportunity now to reflect on the reasons for some of his destructive behavior. And it was simply his own sense of guilt or unworthiness, the fact that we prosecute ourselves. And since we're not very good jailers, then we put that on someone else and destroy people around us, and then we're finally punished. And he is that guy who now repents and then tries to come back and make it right.
I think that's a wonderful synopsis of what that character is and what drives him. He couldn't help it. He hated himself so much, and he dragged the people that loved him down with him. And I did make him in death have a much deeper, richer perspective of himself. He's looking back from a distance. He's freed from the physical confines of his body and the abuse he heaped on it. So he is not a hard-boiled voice. He is a hard-boiled voice tempered by a greater wisdom. And I sometimes get – people sometimes say, well, that doesn't sound like a hard-boiled detective. And I say, well, that's because it's not one.
Well, yeah, he's a hard-boiled detective who's been peeled. I mean, the sense that now that shell of invulnerability has to have been shed, and now we're getting down to the core of the thing that all the hard-boiled detectives are trying to hide and keep you away from.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's great. Will you read for us?
Sure. I will read from the first part, the beginning of Desolate Angel by Chas McGee, and that is the first book in the Dead Detective series. Chapter 1. I never recognized my wife's beauty when I was alive. Distracted by shining eyes and an all-forgiving smile, I married her and stayed married to her for 23 years, never noticing when the shining eyes and forgiving smile faded, casualties of the burdens that came with loving me. But not once in all the years of sharing the very air we breathed did I recognize her true beauty. I had to die before I saw it. I had to die before I realized how her stubborn love for me and her infinite love for our sons made her splendid beyond human comprehension. I can see it now and so much more. I can see the light that surrounds her when she holds our boys in her arms. I can see how the world surrenders before her when she shares that love with others. I have watched her stop to talk to the old man who lives alone next door and seen him smile to himself as he shuffles away afterward, his day brightened by more than memories. I have watched her eyes linger on strangers in the store where she works, noting their slumped shoulders and grim faces. And I have seen her smile at them from across a room crowded with racks of clothes, her smile instantly easing the weight of their unknown disappointments. It is astonishing to me now that she stayed with me and loved me all those years. She deserved better. Through no fault of her own, I came to see her love as a burden rather than a gift, and drank to forget that she loved me. When that did not drive her away, I sought out women willing to drink beside me in hopes of forgetting their own failures. I destroyed everything Connie had ever loved about me, and I don't know why. And yet she loved me still. I know that now and so much more, for now that I am dead, I have little to do except ponder what I have lost. What else do you do when you realize too late that you once had all you ever needed but refused to see it? What do? You try to hold on to what you have already lost. You chase the vapors of what you once had.
Katie Munger as Chas McGee, reading from Desolate Angel, the first in the Dead Detective series. Your characters are getting increasingly complex and nuanced. When you go back to Hubbard and Lil, do you have a sense, are they still all alive in you, or do you see this as a kind of evolution over these?
I actually had to go back through all my books as I was preparing them for ebook format and to bring them back. And I would be reading through them, and sometimes I would reach a passage and go, oh, this is really funny. Nothing like entertaining yourself, right? This is really great. But often I would go, who wrote this? And I would stumble upon passages that I would be proud to say I wrote yesterday, that I feel were nuanced and had deeper meaning. And then I would stumble across a paragraph where I'd just go, oh, my God, 7,000 adjectives in one paragraph. What was I thinking? But all in all, I actually think that the books are an evolution, but I think they also honestly reflect a part of me. Each of them reflects a different part of me. I compartmentalize my life, and I think my books reflect that. I like to reinvent myself every 4 to 5, 6 years. I think my books reflect that. But I think that each series honestly reflects me in that time of my life.
They do stand alone, and they are their own entities, I think, and have their own qualities, and that's why you would read them. But you can see how different they are. And then I wonder if you could go back and write them, given your experience. Once you create a Kevin Fahey, what happens to Hubbard and Lil?
I am not sure I could go back to Hubbard and Lil for one thing. It's a bit of a lost New York at this point, too. It's the 80s, and that's kind of gone. I'm not sure that I see old people in such a curious way now. I think I'm probably a little closer to being 84.
She's not eccentric, for goodness sake.
Yes, I'm going to be that person. I can go back to the Casey Jones, because I have gone back to the Casey Jones, and then I just channel the inner Casey to write them. But once the dead detective gets in you, I'm not sure you can see the world in any other way.
Did Kevin, is that someone who for you, you talked about, I'm going to finish this sentence in a minute, talked about liking series, seeing things as an arc. Did Kevin appear to you kind of beginning, middle, or end, and end, or are you creating his arc as you go along?
I'm creating his arc as I go along. The new book coming out is set in a mental institution, which is just so much fun. The idea of somebody who's in the afterlife but can sort of get into people's minds, being able to get into the minds of people who are mentally ill, and that reflects my great love and sympathy for people struggling with those kinds of things. And there's just this rich interplay, and he learns a lot about himself there. So I sort of choose a setting for each dead detective, and then what can he learn about himself in that setting, and how far can he move forward? And it kind of makes it challenging. I don't have it plotted out what's going to happen next. We'll have to wait and see.
And he has a partner among the living, and she has to change and evolve as well.
She does, and I try not to let her personal life kind of take over. I fear that if Maggie Gunn's personal life took over, it would turn into Sue Grafton Light or something like that, and I don't want that to happen.
Now, mystery writing is not the only thing you do, although with 3 series going, you wonder how you'd have time for anything else, but you do communications work. You worked for a while for Democracy North Carolina, and now – well, first of all, tell us about their work. Remind us what they do.
Well, I spent 3.5 years with Democracy North Carolina, and they're a statewide nonpartisan group, and they do a lot of great work surrounding money and politics and civic engagement, and it was a wonderful education in those really fundamental issues about our political system. But now I have a new gig I'm really excited about, and I'm going to be working with Garrick Brenner, a former WTVD reporter, and Justin Guillory, and we are going to be founding the new chapter of Progress Now, a national organization. It's called Progress North Carolina. And we're going to be sort of taking the news and translating it for people that are very busy and don't have time to pay attention to a lot of in-depth coverage and let them know about the issues affecting quality of life in North Carolina, what new bills have been introduced that might affect it, who's behind it, how it might impact the state in your life, what you can do about it if you've got time to do something about it. And our goal is just to recognize that we are blessed to live in a beautiful, thriving, flexible, diverse state, and we want it to stay that way.
You do have a point of view.
I do have a point of view. We call ourselves progressive, but we define progressive not in political terms. It's more in terms of change is going to come whether you want it or not. And if you want to make progress, you must anticipate and adapt to that change and plan ahead. You must make deliberate investments in education, infrastructure, protecting the natural resources of our state, as we have done since the late 50s in a beautiful way. And we just don't want to see that undone now.
And you've talked about that history, the history of North Carolina to prepare for change.
Yes. I believe that we are the shining light of the South. I believe we prove that you can blend the old with the new, the urban with the rural, that you can foster rich new literature and art without losing sight of the traditions they came from. We've done a great job of making room for everyone in this state, people from, 250 different countries. And we've proved that it can be done. And we've kind of done that by steering a path down the middle, I believe. And I want to make sure we stay that way.
Now, when you talk about issues that affect quality of life, education obviously would be an important one.
Education right now, I think, is the number one issue. I mean, when you look at the promise of America, the only way people born into poverty can ever raise up is a good education. And we cannot and must not allow the public education system to be dismantled. You just cannot.
So how do you think things are going? When you talk about this is going to be web-based, right? So are you going to see, will there be news articles that you'll call? Will you be an aggregator?
In about a month, if people go to www.progressnc.org, they will see a sort of a website with lots of short articles on different issues presented in I'm a writer. I believe in narrative and being entertaining. There's nothing wrong with entertaining people by educating them. I hope it'll be fun for people. And you go, you got a few minutes, quick shot, learn a lot about what's going on, then go back to your life. And when you can put a little more time into it, come back and do something real quick and go back. I think there's room for that for people. And we're hoping to kind of wake up a lot of people not paying attention right now.
Yeah, we joked about your time on Wall Street and doing research on criminal behavior and Wall Street. There you were. But in some ways, it is no joke. The way we structure a criminal justice system will have a huge impact on things like education, on poverty, on health care. And yet we don't see it because it's the air we breathe. People are in uniform. They're wearing suits. And it's the system. Is our criminal justice system, do you think it works? Is it working?
Oh, absolutely not. If you're poor, put a fork in you, you're done. If you're wealthy, you have a very good shot at getting off. It's a bifurcated system. It's not fair. And it's also foolish and unintelligent to view it as standalone. It is absolutely tied to the education system. We can invest $1,000 in a four-year-old now and not have to pay $60,000 a year down the road when they end up in prison. So you have to look at it holistically and recognize that our penal system has to be tied to other systems. We should be diverting people from entering it, not punishing the people, for years and years and years to land in it.
What are the barriers to that, do you think? The economics are obvious. It does cost far less to educate a child. The correlation between education and your impact or becoming part of the criminal justice system is very clear. So pay a few thousand dollars now, pay a lot less. That's obvious. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that these issues are being sensationalized and distilled into sound bites so media ratings can go up or a politician can get elected, and they know better, and they're still choosing not to speak intelligently about these issues. Nothing is black and white. Nothing is easy, but it can be done. We've done it before. We can do it again. We can fix this if we work together, but we have to say we want to fix it. There's human beings involved. What matters is that, we all have a chance at a life that counts and a family and making a living and being able to help ourselves. And it doesn't matter if a certain person gets elected or ratings go up. What matters is fixing the problem. And the only people that can make that happen probably would be the voters.
I want to leave now talking about your work as well. Your novels now, you're working on the Dead Detective series. Do you have another series in the works?
I don't have another series in the works because I kind of have my hands full with my work. And also, I've got a new book I'm working on in the Dead Detective series, which I think is going to be called Face of an Angel, and that's due at the end of March. And then I have to go back and actually do another Casey Jones.
You're bringing her back.
I'm bringing her back. I've got about 75 pages written, and when I'm done with this new Dead Detective, up next is the new Casey Jones.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Frank. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Durham-based mystery writer Katie Munger. Next book in the Dead Detective series, Angel of Darkness, due out in the U.S. in April. You can find out more at her website, katiemunger.com. Katie, K-A-T-Y. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. We're at stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix, Alex Granados, and Isaac Davey Aronson. Robin Copley is our technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.